No one told me.
It's always going to be just out of reach.
Wow, do these people know something I don't know?
Like, the more hours I spend talking in public, the more chances I'll say something wrong and get in trouble.
The good girl archetype was going to be the ruination of the world.
It was this wake up. Cosmic wake up.
Just walking around exclamation points jumping off me at all times.
I love messy humans.
You wanted this life. This is your fault. You chose to do this.
This is The Art of Asking Everything. I am your host, Amanda Palmer. This week's episode is called, How Can We Actually Use the Internet for Good Things? And guess what we have coming up next week in America Land? An election! Are you voting? You better be, you motherfucker. And guess what is awesome for sharing information about politics and voting? The internet! And guess what is also full of lies and conspiracy theories and bullshit? The internet! Oh no! Multitudes! We are lucky. This week's guest is Eli Pariser. Eli is an author, an activist, and an entrepreneur focused on how to make technology and media, read the internet, serve democracy and human beings. You have probably heard of MoveOn.org, and you have probably even used it if you are an American on the internet who has done any sort of political activism. Eli became the executive director of MoveOn.org in 2004, where he helped pioneer the practice of online citizen engagement. He's also the co-founder of Upworthy, which you've probably heard of, a website for meaningful viral content, as he calls it, and Avaaz, which is a large global citizens organization. And in a nutshell, Eli has clocked a lot of hours thinking about how we can use the internet to make things better in the world. I first met Eli through the TED conferences, because we both did talks there. And if you want to check out his TED talk, it's amazing. It's called Beware Online Filter Bubbles. We sat down for this interview at a TED event in Edinburgh in July of 2019, while I was on a break from touring. I had just finished reading his book called The Filter Bubble, What the Internet is Hiding from You, which will be the book that we discuss in the podcast book club in about a month. And oh my God, is this the topic that we need to be talking about right now at the moment? Because it is very important. And I could have talked with Eli for many, 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 many more hours. And hopefully he can come back on the podcast in a couple of months and tell us what the fuck has happened to our country. I can't wait to find out. I'm scared. But for now, let's just go into the past before COVID, before Donald Trump looked like he might actually be the president of the United States of America again. Cross your fingers and listen to me talking with Eli Pariser.
As many people, I think, who end up in communicating or performing are, I like started out as a very awkward, bad communicator. And then,
then you had to get good at it.
Overcompensating because I had to like learn how to do it.
Do you now feel a lot more comfortable talking to people, like public speaking or doing a podcast or whatever? Or is there still a part of you that's sort of weirded out by the whole thing?
I feel reasonably comfortable now, but I, as like a 20-year-old, I was super introverted and just nervous in front of people. I'm not sure what I wanted to say. It's been a journey, but, you know, I've realized mostly like, it's nice to connect with people and they're interested in what I have to say and we can have a good conversation.
One of the weird things about TED is it's a conference, right? So you walk around with a badge and at the bottom of your badge, there's this like, ask me about ...
Yeah.
And I've noticed that actually over the years, people have gotten a lot braver about what they will. Mm. They won't just put like, hiking, craft, brewing.
Yeah.
I've seen
how I killed it.
Mine, for instance, this year says abortion on it. And I actually sort of sat there before I typed the words in and I was like, ooh, that's going to be interesting.
Yeah.
I actually have only had one person point to that and say, so tell me about abortion.
Mm-hmm.
But yours says, ask me about the person and the situation. What does it mean?
Well, it's a book, and my friend Vikram described it as, it sounds like the title of a book where you don't remember the title of the book. It's like a person and a situation. but it's actually, it's a classic of social psychology.
Mm-hmm.
And it's written by this guy, Lee Ross, and his partner, what they are looking at is how, as human beings, we systematically attribute people's behavior to what we think is their like internal character when we should be attributing it to the situation that they're in. So we attribute it to the person, not the situation. Mm. And what's fascinating is there have literally been probably tens of thousands of studies that show how strong this effect is. Mm. You know, just a lot of our intuition about how predictable people are based on their, you know, who we think they are, you're generous, you're extroverted, you're whatever, is just totally wrong.
Not that those things aren't superficially true about this person. They are superficially true.
They're true in situations. So this right. is so one of the reasons that we think that they're true is that it's like I see you at TED and I don't see you with your family or, you know, at home. And so I encounter you in the same kinds of situations. And so you seem like a very similar kind of person when I encounter you. But actually, everybody's had the experience of like, oh, I went drinking with my work colleague. And it was like a totally different thing.
Yeah.
Everybody's like that all the time. But you don't usually get that view. So the book opens with this story about it's an experiment where they had a bunch of religious seminary students who were asked to teach a class about the Good Samaritan, you know, where you stop on the side of the road and help the guy who has trouble. And some of them were told that they had plenty of time, and some of them were told that they were late.
I know the story.
Yeah. And so the ones that were told that they were late.
And when you say late, they were late to...
To walk across the campus to where they had to give the talk. Of course, being devious social psychologists, they put someone who is evidently in trouble halfway between, you know, where they were given these instructions and where they had to go. So the people who were late were stressed out and they totally didn't notice.
The real life person in need.
And the people who were told they were early stopped.
Yeah.
And what's fascinating is...
They were situationally generous.
They were situationally generous. That was much more important than whether they scored high on generosity, how religious they were. None of these sort of factors that you would think would predict who is going to stop and who is not going to stop.
This is very Brechtian concept.
Yeah.
I mean, Bertolt Brecht was always saying it's situational.
Yeah.
You know, if someone's hungry, they're not going to be generous.
Right. 100%. And I actually think it's, for me, the reason it's important is that if our behavior mostly comes from our situations, then figuring out what situations to create for people becomes a really important way to have people be decent to each other.
So if we're all always late, we're all going to be assholes.
Yeah.
Which is what we all are
always late. And,
and now we're all assholes.
Yeah, no.
All right.
We're all walking too fast.
Look, mommy, no hands. I know how to take good care of myself.
We're also living in a situation where instead of tuning into our environment at any given moment, we're fixated on a 3-inch lit up screen very close to our face and we're not really we're not even taking in the situation that we're in.
Right. No, the phone is the situation.
The phone is
like
the situation. And then what's the situation in the phone?
Yeah.
And there's layers and layers and layers.
Totally. The book is really good at like illustrating the concepts. But I hadn't realized myself, you know, it meets up with this sort of esoteric religious stuff where it's like, there is no self, there is no identity. You actually kind of get some of that in this lens too, because you realize like, there is no such thing as like, this person is generous or emotionally attuned or whatever. Like there are people who have extreme versions of those traits. Mostly the way we behave is like a function of what's going on around us.
So do you feel like a big part of your work is examining and trying to help shape the situation?
As an activist, to me, that's like, it's a very hopeful thing in a way, because you don't actually have to change people.
And as we've all learned,
changing people is fucking hard.
You can't change, and you actually can't totally really change people.
Right.
You change the situation.
Yeah. Right. And actually, you know, so this is a little self-helpy, but it's like, I was reading this and I was like, then I was thinking about changing my own behavior. And my narrative to myself about stuff that I'm doing that I don't like, if I'm procrastinating or I'm whatever, is that I'm not trying hard enough, or I have some character flaw that is making this difficult. And I realize, like, if I'm taking this book literally, then my intervention with myself shouldn't be to change my inner traits. Yeah. It should be figure out what situation I'm not going to procrastinate in, which turns out, by the way, that it's not having the internet. Yeah. And like, I'll sit in a room, I'll be annoyed and bored, and then I'll do my work. And that's actually a much more powerful intervention to change your own behavior.
I always feel like I have been a procrastinator.
Yeah.
Which people don't believe when I say it because I'm so prolific, right, and I do all sorts of things. They don't see my inside world, and they don't see the inside of my head, and they don't see that I, like, up in my brain, I'm all bumbling and putting off things and doing other shiny, exciting things that look really productive to people, but actually I'm just procrastinating on the thing that I said I would do, da-da-da-da-da. I did a situational change in songwriting that really changed the way I thought about procrastination and thought about productivity, which is... So the way a song usually works is I get an idea for it, and then if I'm good, I turn everything off, I sit down at the piano, and if I'm really, really good, I stay, you know, like a good dog.
Yeah.
Like I stay until I've written enough of the structure of the thing.
Right.
Like if you were a writer, it would be like your book outline or whatever.
Right.
Enough of the structure of the thing and enough of the song that it's finished enough that it's finishable.
Yeah.
And that it won't just die on the vine.
Mm-hmm.
And part of that discipline included, up until that point, totally turning off the internet, like shutting the computer and putting it in a drawer.
Mm-hmm.
If I was going to sneak into the computer, it would just be to sneak in and look at the online thesaurus or Google some historical fact that I needed for my song, but not get on Twitter and not check my email and not do the bad things that would take me to the bad place.
Yeah.
On this particular occasion, I tried something different.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why.
Mm-hmm.
I had an idea for a song. It had been baking in my brain for a couple of days. I was alone in my apartment in Boston. And I just left the computer open and tweeted like a photo of myself saying, like, I'm about to start a songwriting session. I almost never finish these. I'm a total fucking procrastinator. Please cheer me on.
Yeah.
And I actually kind of left the computer by my side.
Yeah.
And logged my progress.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And was like, I've been actually sitting here for 2 hours and people are like, whoop, whoop, you know, you're doing the thing. Uh-huh. Hooray, Amanda, you're doing the thing. And, you know, I didn't check my email, but I kept checking Twitter.
Right.
And that song that I wrote is called The Bed Song.
Mm-hmm.
It made it onto my next record. It is now one of, it is like one of the songs of my canon. It's one of the best songs I've ever written.
Uh-huh.
And I had to confront that, like, I changed the situation and I did the bad thing.
Yeah.
I kept checking the internet, but also I checked a channel of the internet that was feeding me.
Right. Yeah.
I didn't check my email to find out that, like, someone's FedEx package the day before was lost and I had to all of a sudden get on the phone to track my friend's FedEx. These things that were just going to take me totally out of the flow.
Yeah.
That was really fascinating to me. And I think it may seem like a kind of a silly story, but I think as far as art is concerned and work is concerned, it's a really important story about the internet and how we use it.
Right. Yeah.
And what it... And that it isn't just a big binary, an on-off switch of like, oh, internet bad, internet distracting, internet non-productive, or, you know, even like Facebook, bad, distracting, blah, blah, blah. Or, you know, we forget that we have control over what the internet is.
Right.
Over what email is.
Yeah.
Over what Twitter is, what online activism is.
Right.
It isn't just this big, giant, scary black and white morass.
Yeah. I've been on this weird deep dive on urban planning, and part of the reason is that I'm thinking about how to take urban planning concepts and apply them to the internet. That's my thing right now. So there's this guy, Jan Gehl, who's sort of he's like the descendant of Jane Jacobs. He's this Dutch urban planner who kind of, he has this idea of invitations. So the way he introduces the idea is actually around traffic. And he says, you know, so many cities saw that they had a traffic problem. And what they did was they widened the roads.
Mm.
A wider road is an invitation to cars.
Yeah.
And so there were more cars and more traffic.
Mm.
And this is actually empirically true, that you build bigger roads, it doesn't solve your traffic problem. It actually makes it worse, which is kind of a crazy, because more people drive there.
More people will get cars and drive there, or more people who have cars will use them more often?
If it's like, if people perceive that there's a lot of traffic going to a place, they're not going to go as much.
Mm-hmm.
So then when the road gets widened, they can go to the place that they couldn't go because there was traffic. There's something profoundly human about that little thing, but...
Yeah, we'll just fill any void.
But we'll also do what we're invited to do, right? You know, mostly he talks about invitations in this positive sense of like, what do you want to invite in this space? Specifically, like, do you want to invite quiet conversations? Do you want to invite street parties? Like, it's cool what you want to invite, but know what you want to invite.
Mm.
And so that's sort of what I hear in your Twitter story is like, that was a specific invitation. It wasn't like, tweet at me your badly articulated wrong political opinions. Like, that wouldn't have gone. I'm opening up a little channel with a particular invitation.
I mean, the way that my community has been invited again and again and again and again and again over the years has created a language.
Yeah.
So that when I say X, they're more likely to do Y.
Yeah.
Me and my community of listeners, fans, audience, whatever, have a really respectful relationship.
Yeah.
So for me, it's not really so much a roll of the dice as it is like, I get to do something exciting, because the chances that someone's going to come back at me with something negative at this moment in time are very, very low.
Yeah.
But also, a lot of what the internet has meant is that if you can't control the faucet on that like stream of human car souls that are coming into your like cobblestoned alleyway or your giant nine-lane super Lady Gaga highway, you have to, as an artist, know what your invitation is.
Right.
And I mean, part of the invitation is, are you going to try to sign with a massive label and make algorithmic pop music?
Yeah.
Or are you going to play a single instrument, act like a troubadour, and try to write really soulful songs that will probably never get played on the radio because they're 10 minutes long?
Right.
Because that invites alleyway. But this didn't really used to be true. In the 80s, if you were an artist who wrote soulful songs, like, you still only had one channel to reach, really, if you were going to be a recording artist.
Yeah.
So whether or not you were, you know, Nick Drake, or, you know, like a soulful weirdo songwriter, or you were a giant pop artist, you still only had the superhighway.
Yeah, no.
Wanted to put your songs on records and get them to other human beings around the globe.
It seems like partly the trade has been, on the one hand, lots of different, you can make a vastly broader array of invitations, and artists can have much more deep and complex relationships with their communities. On the other hand, that business model that was working for some people in the 80s that filled in the kind of middle tier of artists, like, has totally collapsed. And now, if you're Lady Gaga, it's great, and probably it's decent to be you. But if you're the troubadour or whatever, it's rough going.
If I were giving a TED Talk right now, which I'm fucking not, because I'm on tour and I have a 3-year-old and I'm not that nuts. But it would be about that.
Yeah.
It would be about the disappearance of the middle class artist, but actually how it is the community's responsibility to pay the salary of the middle class artist and not just take instructions from the media about who and how to support. There's a really easy solution. And the easy solution is every community has its middle class, you know, potential middle-class artists and troubadours and local artists and stuff.
Yeah.
But you have to give them money. Not much money, but people aren't yet trained to do that. I don't think they really get that that's a thing.
Yeah.
And I think when people think about giving money to the arts, they want a simple solution where you just, like, give your pledge to NPR and you give your pledge to the Met and then you've done your thing for the arts.
Right.
And my argument would be to diversify.
Different countries have solved this problem in different ways. And one solution is, you make it more sustainable to be an artist by having a stronger safety net where you can get healthcare, you can live a pretty decent life and not be, you know, working all the time. And there's actually this great analysis, which may be apocryphal, but I like it, of, you know, why does Britain punch above its weight in terms of the artistic export? Partly because, like,
NHS.
Yeah, like all of those systems that Britain had that made it so that you could kind of make it. And it's like my brother and sister-in-law are artists and, you know, musicians doing their thing. It's rough going. They're in Connecticut. She's in a band called Rhett and Molly, and they have a thing together called Goodnight Moonshine. Yeah, they're doing what they love. But America does not make it easy to do what you love.
No.
And, you know, and by the way, they're working hard at it. There's a whole other conversation about Americans and the need to say, but they're working hard.
Yeah. Yeah. No, they're really, that's their Puritan roots.
Yeah. No,
they're being productive. They're contributing.
Yeah. So part of it is, let's make it a virtue to contribute to artists. I totally am with you. But part of it is like, how do we do that at a societal level, where we may open up more possibility for people to do these things, especially if you're not coming from a middle-class background yourself?
If you want to get into that conversation, oh my God, there's so much shit we could fix. We could make things better for everybody. Yeah. We could make it possible and not unthinkable to be a touring artist and a mother, for example, which right now is pretty much an impossible task if you don't have...
Are you doing it? You're
I'm doing it, but I'm super fucking lucky. Yeah. You know, I'm an established artist. Yeah. I'm married to another established artist. We have tons of dough.
Yeah.
We can hire childcare. We can do this. We can do that. We can take turns working.
Yeah.
You know, I'm friends with a lot of musicians who have children, and they struggle because if you're an artist, and even if you're an artist who's making it, you live really, really close to the edge.
Yeah.
And if you have a kid, that can push you over the edge.
Totally.
And it can push you, you know, into catastrophe and into debt and into how am I going to go take this gig?
Yeah.
You know, if I don't have childcare and if I bring the kid with me, am I being a good parent? And
So. No, I mean, this is their life. And even stuff like, you know, they want to enroll my nephew in public school, but you can't miss more than
X number of days.
Yeah,
the system is not set up for touring musicians in America.
I don't know why. I mean, it's such a, you know, we like touring musicians in America, but...
But that's the problem everywhere is we both worship and completely ignore the plight of the working artist. I want to go back to your TED Talk, the concept of the filter bubble and the conversation around and the idea of the danger of people living in their little internet compartments and silos and not getting information through and from the other side is now national news.
Yeah.
You have a unique vantage point.
Yeah.
What are you thinking about all of that right now?
So the talk ends by like kind of calling personally on Larry Page and Sergey Brin, who were there to like do better on this, and Zuckerberg too. Yeah, I thought, okay, might be poisoning the well here for a while in terms of you know how I relate to those companies, but so be it. You know, I think initially it stirred up some good conversation, and then there was this period where kind of the companies all came out and said very definitively, this is not a thing.
Facebook
and Google, you know, it was like on earnings calls that they would get asked about it. And they would say that Chris Cox, the chief product officer at Facebook, or Marissa Meyer, or, you know, would say like, yeah, we've looked into it.
It's not a thing.
Fake news before that time. And it was this very strong shutdown. I try to approach things listening carefully and sincerely and at face value. And so there was this period where I really thought, like, did I get it wrong or did I over-exaggerate it or what was I missing that they would be that definitive? To be honest, it's like having now spent 7 years with the idea, it is complicated. And there are people who experience it more. There are people who experience it less. It totally depends on how you consume media, which varies greatly from different groups of people. Then the 2016 election happened. Zuckerberg famously was asked about it like a couple days after the election and was like, I think that's nonsense. What did they know is a question. I think probably I give them even more of the benefit of the doubt than they deserve in some cases, because they do think there were people who had some sense. But I also think it wasn't on the radar. And I've run a company, and like, you only have attention for limited things, and you focus on the stuff that people internally or externally are stressed about. And democracy wasn't one of those things. So then there was this big turn after 2016, and everybody came back and said, well, it kind of is an issue, and invited me in for conversations. And there was this whole different posture. And I guess the reason I say that is, like, you know, it's not as if I felt all the way through like, oh, the world's one day gonna prove me right or whatever. And I didn't really even want that. I was kind of trying to like have a public conversation about an idea, you know, and it's been a journey with the idea. The one other piece is like, after the 2016 election, people started to say, well, the filter bubble, that's what elected Trump. I don't believe that at all.
What do you believe?
Talk radio and Fox. Demographically, on non-college educated white men in the upper Midwest, they're not on Twitter at all.
Mm-hmm.
They're barely on Facebook, but they're listening to a couple hours of talk radio a day, and they're listening to a lot of Fox. And that's an incredibly powerful channel that you and I don't experience at all. With your most devout community members, you probably don't get a couple hours a day of their time, right? Like, that's a lot of time with someone.
Socially, that's as deep as it gets.
Right.
Like, listening to your fellow tribes people discussing the issues of the moment with one another and confirming each other's beliefs.
Yeah.
Is, I assume, socially one of the most powerful things that we take in.
Yeah, and a feeling of being seen, you know, and a feeling of being represented. It does feel absurd to me sometimes that these older white men are like, where are the old white men in the national conversation? When do we get to talk? There is a feeling of like, other voices are coming in.
Well, especially when there's a younger black president.
Yeah, exactly.
Someday you're going to be an old white man. How do you feel about that?
I'm not just a white man. I'm a straight white man who is tall. Like, it's so ridiculous that being tall gives you anything. And yet it actually, you know, social science says you get so much from just like a few extra inches, you know. So on the one hand, I feel like I've over-benefited from that. A lot of my responsibility in the world is like to transfer that benefit to people who haven't had it.
Thanks for doing that, by the way.
I'm trying. Change is hard, you know, and I do feel like people sometimes, in their frustration, legitimately, in their anger about what Trump followers are doing, forget that, like, it's hard for anyone to go from feeling unassailably on top to not. That's just, whether or not they earned it or deserve it, it's just like, people don't deal with that emotionally well. On the one hand, you don't want to coddle that. When someone's having like some bad family experience and it shows up in their work or something in a way that's not cool, it's like, on the one hand, you want to say like, well, you can't behave that way. And on the other hand, you want to say, but I also get that you're human and you're going through a hard thing, and that like shows up in various ways in what you do.
Have you changed your interneting practices?
It's a battle, honestly. I think about the internet, I write about the internet because I kind of care about the internet. I like want it to be good. I'm not things were just better. And I really think society was so screwed up in the good old days in so many ways. We don't want to go back. But also the way this is turning out isn't cool at all. Really, the thing that I'm trying to do with social media in particular, because I like using social media, and like you, I have some really good experiences. I mean, as a parent, I just posted this question that's been in my mind about basically like where the line is between cultivating sort of determination and grit. And my son is a boy, and like I don't want him to suppress negative feelings and experiences. You know, I don't want him to be a stoic, right? But there's like, that's a very funky, complicated, just in practice. It's like, he's like, I don't want to keep swimming. And I'm like, okay, do we honor that you have this feeling? And, you know, or do we like, how does this actually work out? Well, this is actually one of the interesting things about all the feedback I got on that question, which is like, I realized like, oh man, all these kids are so different. And like, people were like, oh, well, I just do this. And I was like, that would never in a million years just work. But it's also, you know, just a profound experience to hear other parents, like lots of other parents, talk about that. So I really value that. But I do try to...
When you say value that, you just mean the humanity connecting on the internet, doing humanity.
Yeah. But also, I got this advice from Dana Boyd, who is one of the smartest thinkers around on the internets. But it was about trying to cultivate a sense of awareness about really emotionally, honestly, what am I trying to do here? And sometimes it's like, well, I want likes, I want affirmation or whatever. And that just like, and sometimes that's fine and whatever. I'm going to post like a picture of me doing something cool. It feels good to celebrate that with people who I know.
Mm.
But sometimes it's like, this is going to be an unsatisfying way to live out that intention. Maybe I need to like rethink this relationship. It's like anything. It's like drinking, right? Like, great. Like I want to like have a nice time with a friend. Awesome. But like, I feel too anxious to really be myself. Like, maybe it'd be better if you could like try to
go get tea.
Yeah. Or like whatever it is that's stopping you from being anxious and, you know, from being yourself.
Well, that's where things get weird.
Yeah.
And for people like me, for instance, my own relationship with authenticity is just, I still can't figure it out. Because the underlying motivation for any of these things is always at its base, just I want connection. I had something really distressing happen yesterday, which is for the first time in my touring life as a mom, being away from my kid, because I'm away from my almost four-year-old for a week now.
Right.
I got the text from Neil and our babysitter that Ash was sent home from camp.
Oh, wow.
For being bad.
Oh, man.
And he had been warned.
Mm-hmm.
So he had been like hitting and biting other kids. Mm-hmm. And they were like, if this happens a third time, we call you and we're sending him home. And I know, because Neil and I watch the patterns, that this is happening because I'm gone, because he does this and he acts out at school or camp or nursery when we're gone. One of us is gone.
Yeah.
So first of all, I'm carrying the guilt of, oh, I'm a shitty mother. I'm not there with my kid. I'm not there to deal with it either. And da, 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 da. But also, I noticed that, like, the thought danced through my mind, do I say anything about this on the internet?
Yeah.
And my immediate instinct was no.
Mm-hmm.
But then yesterday, I did a big ninja gig.
Yeah.
And 200 of my patrons gathered before the ninja gig, which was like 1,000 people out in a big park in Edinburgh.
Yeah.
But we gathered in a little tent, and it was just my patrons at 8:30, and they all had a secret password screen thing, and they came in this tent. And someone said, how's Ash? Because, you know, I did sort of a Q&A or like, does anyone want to share anything? Open mic. And this is something that my fans, my community, have been asking me for 4 years. And I always have an exciting answer.
Right.
Like, he's great and he's beautiful and I love it.
Yeah.
And this was the first time where my immediate answer or my immediate thought was, do I tell them the truth?
Right.
So that, like, I'm struggling.
Yeah, yeah.
And this bad thing happened.
Mm-hmm.
And so I told the story.
Mm-hmm.
And I also sort of told the story about not really wanting to share the story.
Right.
Because it's that thing where, like, posting about your child biting someone on Instagram or Facebook not only, like, invites comments that you don't necessarily want, or, like, you then have to defend your parenting and stuff.
Yeah.
But I still wouldn't go back and take this to the internet. But I still got to take it to my community.
Yeah.
My safe community of 200 people who could sort of sit there and be like, oh, that sounds really shitty. We're sympathetic. We're laughing about it. We all have kids. Which is probably what would have happened on the internet.
Yeah.
But I also just wasn't ready to open up that invitation to the internet criticizing my parenting or giving me parenting advice that I didn't want. What we choose to show, reflect, share.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I try to do on the internet as a person with a following is share as much negative, shitty humanity as I feel I can handle.
Yeah, yeah.
Without opening up the door to so much extra energy that I can't handle it. And you have to be really careful that you don't throw anyone else under the bus, because I can't hop onto Twitter and be like, I've just had a fucking fight with Neil Gaiman and he won't fucking like, because that's just not allowed. So it needs to be very eye-centric. And then there's all these questions about, like, did your kid ask, allow you consent to talk about his biting issues?
Yeah.
It has something to do with how real we be on the internet. Because my experience is usually when I post that kind of stuff, I just see relief. Like, I just see people going, oh, it's so nice to see people sharing these kinds of stories about their kids instead of just cute, sticky-faced ice cream selfies.
Yeah. It's really hard as a parent to figure out how and when to talk about this stuff, because there's so much about your identity, so much about, like, this person that you want to protect more than anything in the world. All of these things are just so bound up. And also, who hasn't had biting, or, like that is a natural part of, you know, I read some book recently that was, like, four-year-olds is when kids are the most violent in their life. Just like if you look at like, like blows cast
blows per day.
Like you will never be hopefully like more violent than that. So anyway,
That's actually really comforting.
Yeah, no, see, there you go. I gave a talk once about shame and social change from actually kind of some thoughts that had been percolating at Upworthy. The thing that I think people forget about shame is like, well, what is shame? Shame is a cultural tool for creating conformity in a group and setting agreed standards of behavior. Who sets the agreed standards of behavior, right? Dominant groups set the agreed standards of behavior, right? That's true in any society. It's almost by definition true, right? Usually what is shameful is what dominant groups want not to be expressed. And so I actually think there's this, it's literally powerful to share those experiences, because you're literally pushing up against a bunch of ideas about how parenthood should be, how mother, there's all these fucking crazy ideas about how motherhood should be.
Oh, I know.
Yeah. And how do you push against that if not by sharing those stories? Like, that's the most powerful way.
Yeah.
There's a bunch of complicated feelings about that stuff, because it can feel very like self-centered or vulnerable at the same time.
Or non-consensual.
Like, yeah, or non-consensual. But yeah. I just do think, like, we were going to talk about abortion, but it's like, that's one big change that's happened recently is people have, like, I was always pro-choice, but, like, hearing my friends talk about what it was like really is different, you know, and really feels different than having it be this secret, shameful thing that happens to some random people.
I literally had a conversation about something directly connected to this yesterday with my friend Simone, who's here at TED, who did a great talk a couple of years ago. And we were talking about miscarriage. And we were talking specifically about the 3-month rule, that you don't tell someone
you're pregnant
until 3 months in, and how when I had a miscarriage after, so I had 3 abortions, then I had Ash, and then I was pregnant about 2 years later, and I had a miscarriage at about 3 months. And both times that I was happily pregnant and carrying out a pregnancy, I followed that rule.
Yeah.
And found myself really questioning why.
Yeah, yeah.
And
by the way, it's also just, it's such a fucked up rule, because not only does it stop people from talking about this painful thing that happened. I mean, I have to check with my wife if it's cool to say this, but like we experienced that 3 times between our 2 kids.
A miscarriage.
Yeah. And it was intense and terrible. And it's also intense and terrible because there's not even,
Knows.
like, people don't know what to say. There's no, like, funeral for the, like,
no, so idea baked, of the baby. Baked into that 3-month rule is a message
right.
that you're not supposed to bother your community.
Yeah. But here's the other...
With the loss.
Yeah, so and then even beyond that, the flip side of it that's also horrible is that in the first trimester, when you're feeling fucking awful...
Nobody knows.
You're supposed to, like,
it's
pretend...
The worst. That, well, like, and it
like,
actually...
imagine telling a bunch of men that, like, you're going to have gastroenteritis for 3 months, but
you're not
you can't tell
it.
If anyone at work even kind of thinks that you do, that's not cool.
Yeah.
Like,
well, and that's where the concept of pro-choice needs to be introduced.
Yeah.
That if you are not yet feeling like handling the society, the shift of society towards you as a pregnant person,
yeah,
your choice.
Yeah, yeah.
But if I were to get pregnant again, I would tell my community on day one.
Yeah.
On day one.
Mm-hmm.
So that if I went through a miscarriage,
yeah,
3 weeks later, 6 weeks later, 12 weeks later, I'd be supported.
Yeah.
And the message is, it's a message of non-support.
Yeah.
It's a message of shame.
Yeah.
Basically.
Right.
Like, stay in your closet and don't bother us until you have good fucking news.
Right. Yeah.
It's very dark.
No, it totally, I mean, it totally is. And, you know, without getting to, like, classic feministy, like...
Oh, please don't. Not on this podcast, Eli.
I know it's inappropriate. But, like, you know, that's like, I mean, that is patriarchy, right? Like, that's just...
It's I have Handmaid's Tale sitting
of,
on
know,
my bed. That's like, some pretty Handmaid's Tale,
yeah,
shit.
Yeah, no, it's just... It's not of use to us men to hear about all this gross, you know, detail.
Well, I'm sorry.
No, yeah. I mean, I'm like, that's what I, you know, and it's so, you know, it's so damaging for whole families, I think, because people just don't.
Is this something that you've talked about?
No. Yeah. So, I mean, I really do have to check with her, but
yeah, you should, And
I mean, we've talked with friends, but I haven't.
Yeah, but I'm also, I'm really impressed by you sharing that story.
Oh, thanks.
And one of the additionally weird things about this and about abortion,
yeah,
is, you know, I appreciate that you want to get your partner's consent, and that's good. But also men get, and partners get really disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes in these conversations.
Totally. Yeah.
You know, because they're going through the miscarriage and the abortion emotionally.
Yeah.
And yet they're kind of not in the center of the story.
Right.
And
which
that,
for us men is very hard not to be.
I know. I mean,
you were being sympathetic. I was being,
no, I mean,
sarcastic.
But I'm not being sarcastic.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Because it's not simple.
Yeah, right.
And it's not easy,
mm-hmm,
for a man who has has partnered with a female bodied person who,
yeah,
was pregnant,
right,
to emotionally go through a miscarriage.
Yeah.
You actually fucking go through something.
No, yeah.
And yet it's not really your story.
Yeah.
But it is.
Yeah.
I mean, again, I may
go back and but for me, it took me a while also to one of them was pretty early on,
mm,
and I was kind of like, eh, we'll try again. No big deal. And it took me a while to like key into like what my wife's experience was about it. And,
yeah,
and also probably my own experience when I wasn't being like, it's all going to be fine. I'm just going to kind of shrug this off.
Yeah.
Because it is a little, it's a death of a possibility in a certain way, or a death of a person you imagine or something like that. And it's just like that we don't have a place.
Miscarriage
isn't even a good word. You know, it's like, it's such a weird word, you know?
Yeah.
Like it has this.
It has this weird,
like,
negative.
Train going off the rails feeling.
Hopefully by the time this podcast comes out, your TED Talk will be
right
out.
Yeah, yeah.
Can you summarize, like, just sort of lead us,
yeah,
through,
yeah,
the idea?
You know, a lot of our online situations, when you sort of back up and look at them and say, like, what is this situation? It's just not a good situation for the kinds of behavior, the kinds of relationships that one wants. What the talk is about is, like, if we think about these as spaces where people are relating, we know from social psychology that spaces shape behavior, right? And you and I are sitting in chairs across from each other, pretty close.
In a dark room.
And we wouldn't have the same conversation if there was a big audience, if we were in the middle of a bustling, you know, airplane terminal or whatever. Like, it just wouldn't happen. And so, so then my partner in this effort, Talia Stroud, and I, you know, said, well, who knows how to structure spaces well for the public good? Urban planners are the people who have been thinking about this the longest and people who have studied cities, because cities are our model for how strangers can live together, mostly without killing each other, and do cool things together. That's the best example we've got. How do we actually take all of that thinking that's gone into where do we put parks and how do we design benches and all this stuff about how people relate when they're strangers, and how do we bring it to digital platforms? I don't think, you know, it's the whole answer, but I do think that there are things that you learn or that you think about when it's a physical space that a lot of the platforms aren't yet thinking about, and that can make things a little bit better.
This has been the Art of Asking Everything podcast. Thank you, of course, to my guest, Eli Pariser. The engineer for this interview was Liam Tate in Edinburgh, Scotland. The theme song that you're listening to right now is a song called Bottom Feeder from my 2012 crowdfunded album, Theater is Evil. I would like to give a shout out to Jarek Bischoff, who arranged the beautiful in-between orchestral music that you heard in this podcast. Those are all little snippets from my latest album, There Will Be No Intermission, which you should listen to if you like really sad songs. Jarek took motifs from my song and made those lovely arrangements. And you can go support Jarek over on his Patreon. He's a fantastic musician, and your support would mean a lot to him. To access all the music that you heard in this episode, you can go to the new and improved amandapalmer.net/podcast. A million thanks to my podcast assistant, social media helper, and additional engineer, Xanthia O'Connor. This podcast was produced by Fanny Coe. Thanks always to everyone at Team AFP, Haley, Michael, Jordan, and Alex. I love you guys so much. Thank you for everything you do. Extra special thanks to Nick Rizzuto, Brittany Bomberger, Ali Cohen, and Braxton Carter. This podcast would not be possible without patronage. I currently have 15,000 people who are supporting me so that this podcast can have no ads, no sponsors, no censorship. We can just be the media, make the media, and say the things we need to say without any middlemen. Special thanks are due to my high-level patrons, Simon Oliver, St. Alexander, Bertie Black, Ruth Ann Harnish, and Leela Cosgrove. Please go to my Patreon, become a member, and help me make this. All of my patrons also have access to a follow-up live chat that I am doing with almost every podcast guest. That is very exciting. I do it every Friday. If you get on the Patreon, you can join us, ask questions, and be part of a smaller conversation. I also make a Patreon post about every podcast with behind-the-scenes info and pictures and notes. For now, signing off, this is Amanda fucking Palmer. Keep asking everything.